Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast presented by Bradford Literature Festival. This episode explores the historical culture and religious significance of one of the world's oldest and most contested cities, Jerusalem. Holy to the three major Abrahamic faiths, Jerusalem serves as a focal point for millions of believers worldwide. But in the modern context, what does this ancient city stand for today? Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, discover Jerusalem through the ages and its testament throughout time.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Bradford Literary Festival, and thank you for coming to this session. My name is Salma Gabbar. I'm a writer of fiction and a lawyer, and I'll be chairing this session. I'm really happy. I've got these two extraordinarily erudite and articulate men here to speak on today on this panel. So I'm going to introduce them first, and then Matthew is going to give a presentation, a short presentation about his book when we'll sit down, and then I'll come back up for a general discussion between us. We're going to leave about 15 minutes at the end for Q&A, so please store up some great questions or even not so great questions that you can ask them about. Okay, so Matthew, to introduce him first, is a journalist and a writer who's written for The Guardian, Independent, Times, Financial Times, and other media. He produces and presents documentaries for the BBC, for BBC Radio 4 and the World Service, and has reported often to from our own correspondent. And he's the author of The Rough Guide to Jordan.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah, that was a while ago. Yes.
The Rough Guide to Jordan. The Rough Guide to Jordan and Quite Alone, Journalism from the Middle East from 2008 to 2019. I'm delighted to be meeting him again. Last time I saw him, he was speaking at a PALFest, which is a Palestinian Festival of Literature event in London, which had been cancelled on numerous occasions by the venue and would not host us. And it was very important to have Matthew there as a voice to give his account and the way that his views on the current situation in Palestine. And pleasure to introduce him to you. And here on my left is Dr. Abdurrahman Azam, who I haven't had the pleasure of meeting before, and I'm delighted to be in his company and also to be in the position of being able to introduce his work to a broader audience, because he's a writer with a range of interests that are quite stunning and impressive, and we will go into those further. He is a historian and an author with publications including Salah ad-Din, The Triumph of the Sunni Revival, which is available outside, The Other Exile, which was written in 2017, which is also some copies of I saw outside, and O Regresso di Sebastião.
The Return of Sebastião, yeah.
It's only the Return of the Sebastian.
So far, only in Portuguese.
I'm saying it in Portuguese because it came out in Portuguese first, which came out 2 years ago. And between 2007 and 2017, he worked as Director of Communications and Cultural Advisor to Her Highness Sheikha Musa bint Nasser Al Misnid, the chairperson of the Qatar Foundation, which I'm linked to because the Qatar Foundation at one point formed a union with Bloomsbury Publishing, who published my first novel out of it, so I'm very grateful for its creation. In 2010, he led the partnership between the Qatar Foundation and the British Library. Azam has also worked as a senior expert advisor on Al-Madar for the inaugural Islamic Arts Biennale in 2023 and has been appointed as one of the artistic directors for the forthcoming Islamic Arts Biennale in 2025, which will take place in Jeddah. Sheikh? Okay, introduction's over. I'm going to hand over to Matthew. He's going to give a short presentation about Jerusalem and his book, and then we shall be back.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much indeed. So yes, I'll say also to this half of the room, once we're done, I'll move this lectern out of the way so you can see my marvellous visage for the rest of the hour. Thank you very much indeed, Salman. Thank you, Abdurrahman, as well. Thank you to Lizzie and Isla from the Bradford Literary Festival as well for their invitation, and also to my co-speakers as well for agreeing to create a conversation. It's really an honour to share this stage and to be here today to speak about Jerusalem, which is not my city, and Jerusalem will never be my city. While I was researching and writing this book, I was very aware of 150 years, maybe even more, 175 or 200 years of people like me, white, English-speaking, middle-aged, middle-class, well-educated, well-spoken, men in particular men, publishing books and standing on stages like this one, claiming Jerusalem for themselves or for their nation or for their empire or in some cases for their religion. That's not why I've done what I've done, as I hope you'll see if you get a chance to read the book as well. I wrote this book because I could see an imbalance in narratives about Jerusalem in my culture, English, our culture, English-speaking culture. And because of my work as a journalist, I'm lucky to have a platform from which to speak. And I wanted to use that platform to help redress the balance. But it's a tricky word, balance. We hear it most often in relation to the news media, and it conjures images of a seesaw. It implies there are two sides. In this case, an Israeli side, which is very often conflated wrongly with a Jewish side, and a Palestinian side. Devote equal resources to both sides, the wisdom runs, and you will achieve balance. You know, the seesaw will be level. But as I set out to show in this book, Jerusalem has many more sides than two. It would be misleading to reduce Jerusalem to two sides, ideas of two sides, and ideas about those two sides being irreconcilable are a fiction. And any balance that may result from treating two sides equally will never be an equitable balance, because Israel has the overwhelmingly larger proportion of assets, power, money, status, influence, global visibility. The seesaw is not level to begin with. So to achieve an equitable balance, you have to act unequally. So this book, I didn't take equal numbers of stories about Jewish people and Jewish Jerusalem and everybody else. The book favors those who begin with fewer advantages. I'm choosing to amplify the voices of the unlistened to. I'm very, very lucky indeed to have been visiting Jerusalem since I was a child. This is a map of the old city of Jerusalem, which is the historic core at the center of a city which now sprawls much more widely. It's still behind its 450-year-old walls. My first visit was in 1980. And then in 1982, when I was 13, my father arranged for me to have my bar mitzvah twice, once at the synagogue that we used at home in South London, and then again at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And I've been coming back all my life, traveling, living, working, visiting. The Old City is where not all, but most of the holy places are, including the main sites of prayer for Christianity, which I've marked in red, Islam in green, and Judaism in blue, which all lie within a few minutes' walk of each other. This place, the Old City, is not large. The area inside the walls is about half a square mile only, and about 35,000 people live there, 90% of whom are Palestinian. So one motivation for me for writing this book was, on all those visits over my teens, and my 20s and my 30s and 40s, was seeing how people like me, outsiders, visitors, tourists, pilgrims, would marginalize the people who live and work beside the holy spaces inside the old city. Because Jerusalem is the most famous city in the world, many people who come arrive with an idea of what it should be like, expecting a place of spiritual perfection. And the people, it's not a place of spiritual perfection, obviously, but the people who live there and who live beside the holy places, which are the focus of a spiritual journey, are too often seen as being less important than the holy places themselves. I thought that was wrong from an early age, and I was thinking for a long time about how I might address that, how I might write about it and undermine it and overturn those impressions. Another motivation was seeing how the reality of the old city didn't match up to the maps that all the people like me, the visitors and the outsiders and the pilgrims, were using. These are two images which I've taken from the internet. They're taken from news media, but they're very similar to images of the old city of Jerusalem that you might find in tourist map or an atlas or a guide. And they, as you can see, show, as these maps invariably do, the old city divided into four: Muslim quarter, Christian quarter, Armenian quarter, Jewish quarter. And very often, like on these, with these sharp, clear lines of division between, these are even color-coded. But if you visit, and I'm sure many people in this room have visited, you will know that the reality on the ground is quite different. There is no sharp dividing line between, say, the Christian quarter and the Muslim quarter. The sense of exclusivity that these maps engender is quite wrong. There are churches in the Muslim quarter, there are mosques in the Jewish quarter, there are people living everywhere. But people approaching Jerusalem for the first time and seeing these maps, I thought, might imagine that somehow these quarters are holy. This is a holy city. It's been divided holily into holy quarters. That's a mistake. But from that mistake, it's then a short step to the next mistake, which is thinking that perhaps Christians, say, aren't even allowed into a Muslim quarter, or that Jews may not enter an Armenian quarter, say. So then you have a situation where, say, a Christian visitor to Jerusalem thinks that the Muslim quarter is somehow enemy territory. This is not my place. It's off limits to me, and I shouldn't go there, which is quite wrong. Where did these ideas come from? I started to do some research. Now, the history of the cartography of Jerusalem, is a whole degree course by itself. And it's, you could pursue it in a lifetime of study. What I've done is reduce it to one slide and about 30 seconds of chat. So these are representations of some of the early maps of Jerusalem. That one on the top is the oldest one that survives today, which is a mosaic laid on the floor of a church in what's now Jordan. But from then, you can see through the Middle Ages, Jerusalem is depicted very often in this sort of idealized form, either as a circle, perfect circle, down in the bottom corner, which is taken from a biblical reference, or as this sort of European-style castle. But similarly, all through this era, we have Arabic sources which speak of Jerusalem as a mixed cluster of neighborhoods. One historian speaks of 39 quarters of Jerusalem in the 13th, 14th century. Another one describes 18 quarters in 1495. These are organic. These are neighborhoods which had developed from the bottom up. And that situation lasted through to Napoleon. In 1798, Napoleon invades first Egypt and then Palestine. And he brings with him, as well as military forces, he brings artists and scholars and scientists and explorers, brings this surge of interest in Europe in Arab and Turkish culture. And very shortly afterwards, we begin to see maps of Jerusalem appearing based not on these sorts of idealized forms or as Jerusalem as a fortress from Europe, but maps based on measurements taken in the field. This is one of the early ones. This is from 1835. There's loads of interest here in these maps, and I could talk for a long time about all the different details of the map. As with all of these maps, what I've done is I've just highlighted one label there. As with all of them, the only label referring to ethno-religious settlement within Jerusalem is the Jews' quarter. Although at this time as well, we begin to see in some of these maps the emergence of labels for the Armenian convent, which I've highlighted, and the Greek convent and the Latin convent. These are areas of Christian settlement around churches, which reflect the European concerns of that time. And this period, the 1830s, was a time of political upheaval in Jerusalem and in all of Palestine as well. There had been a rebellion led from Egypt, which had challenged Ottoman rule. There was a popular uprising in Palestine itself, which led to a power vacuum. European powers were jockeying for position, trying to restore order, but also trying to take advantage of the instability as well, to advance their own interests. This is a period when we see foreign consulates opening for the first time in Jerusalem. British consulate opened in 1839. Then in 1840, Britain, as we have done in other places, essentially bombed Palestine into submission and then handed Palestine back to the Ottoman authorities. British forces remained. There was a team of royal engineers who were tasked with surveying the land of Palestine up and down the coast. And then in 1841, two of them, two lieutenants, arrived to survey Jerusalem. But that conflict of 1840 wasn't just about geopolitics. British evangelical Protestant missionaries had long had their eye on the unevangelized people of the Ottoman Empire. They were unable to convert Muslims because Ottoman law at that time stipulated death for people who converted away from Islam. They were unable to convert Catholics or Orthodox Christians, partly because there was little willingness within those communities to convert, but also partly because France was protecting Catholic rights, Imperial Russia was protecting Orthodox rights, which left Britain out in the cold somewhat. They wanted to protect a community, but they had nobody to protect. The Britain wanted this religious excuse to intervene in Jerusalem, and also a diplomatic excuse to seek privileges from the Sultan in order to compete with the status of France and Russia. And there had long been, and it still is today, a strain in evangelical thinking that sees the conversion of the Jews as being a prelude to the second coming of Christ. So we see at this time all British efforts going into converting the Jews to Christianity and then serving as their diplomatic protector, which meant that the Brits needed to know exactly who was living where. At this time, Britain appointed the first Protestant bishop of Jerusalem, a man called Michael Alexander, who, appropriately enough, was formerly a rabbi who converted away to Christianity. He arrived as bishop in 1842, and with him was a young chaplain named George Williams, aged 27. And Williams was only in Jerusalem just about a year or so, just a little bit more. He was posted elsewhere after that. In 1849, he published a new edition of his book, The Holy City, and it included a map, which had been drawn from the Royal Engineers Survey of a few years previously, and Williams added all the labeling to it, including Christian Quarter, Muslim Quarter, Armenian Quarter, Jewish Quarter. As far as I can tell, George Williams, age 27, was the instigator of the idea of dividing Jerusalem into four quarters. Maps before him did not show them, and just about every single map made since has shown them. There's a direct line from George Williams in 1849 to the maps of Jerusalem that we all see and use today, reinforced in the media, in literature, in guidebooks, in academia, in tourist maps, in every conceivable medium. Why has the idea of the four quarters survived? It survived because it suits the colonial ambitions of successive waves of the rulers of Jerusalem, right down to our own time. The quarters, these four quarters, are false. They were invented in the 19th century by an old Etonian British missionary, aged 27. They always were false, but it suited Jerusalem's colonizers to divide the city's populations against themselves, to foster sectarian division. Williams himself, this is an extract from his book, was even aware that he was deliberately marginalizing the lived experience of Jerusalem's own people. If you remember the 39 quarters from the 13th, 14th century, and the 18 quarters, and if you think even today of all the communities, all the different ethnicities and religions and social identifications of all the different communities who live and work inside the old city, for Williams and for all of Jerusalem's map makers since, they are all, as it says here, numerous but unimportant. I beg to differ. Those subdivisions which reflect the mixed nature of Jerusalem's population are very, very important. As a journalist, you know, I'm specifically interested in how we think of Jerusalem when we only ever see it depicted as being divided into sectarian, ethno-religious quarters. I just want to take in just a few of Jerusalem's many, many marginalized communities of today. I was very lucky indeed to meet and spend some time with, talking to, and also writing about these people at the Indian Hospice. Jerusalem has many of these hospices. This is a word which in this context refers to a Muslim religious institution, specifically one related to Sufism, to mystical Islam. This is a really fascinating place. This commemorates a legendary visit to Jerusalem 800 or so years ago by Baba Farid Shakarganj, who is one of India's most celebrated mystics. He's still revered to this day by Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs. He's supposed to have meditated here for 40 days, and there's still a cave and a small mosque within the boundaries of the compound, the Indian Hospice compound in Jerusalem, which is now home to this little cluster of Indian Palestinian families, or rather one extended Indian Palestinian family. Just nearby is the Afghania Hospice and the Bukharia Hospice, which are built back to back to each other, creating this little community with this centuries-long tradition of hosting Muslims from Bukhara and the neighboring lands of Central Asia, Uzbeks and Tajiks and Turkmen and Afghans and Uyghurs and others as well. Nearby to that is a neighborhood that is home to Jerusalem's Dom families, who self-identify as gypsies. Now, that word has a troubled history in English. It was invented around the 15th century because English people were looking at these newcomers who were arriving amongst them. They didn't know who they were or where they came from. They thought they had maybe come from Egypt, so they called them gypsies as a truncation of Egyptians. And over the centuries, the word has taken on pejorative meanings to such an extent that today some people prefer not to use it at all. But in English, the Dom of Jerusalem choose to self-identify with the word gypsy, so I'm following their lead in that. Their history, very underwritten, very under-researched, obviously, begins with waves of migration roughly 1,500 years ago out of India. And then these waves of migration westwards from India, some people stopped and settled in Armenia and the lands of the Caucasus. They are the Lom people, who are still there today. Some carried on moving westwards into southern southeastern Europe and then up into northern and western Europe. They are the Rom or the Roma. And some settled in Turkey and Iran and the Arab lands, what we now call the Middle East. And they are the Dom. Lom, Rom, and Dom all share a common heritage going back to India. And today there are roughly 20,000 or so Dom people living in the West Bank and Gaza, plus about 1,000 or so in Jerusalem. And Dom have lived inside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem for 200 years or more. And inevitably, as with communities of Roma here as well, they suffer appallingly from racism, from discrimination. They identify neither as Palestinian nor as Israeli. They occupy this tiny socio-political space between these two larger communities. They identify as Dom. And so, to some degree, inevitably, they face racism from both sides as being outsiders to both larger communities. Dom children very rarely graduate from high school. Unemployment rates within the community are high, as much as 2/3. Jobs where they exist tend to be very low-level service jobs related to public sanitation, drain cleaning and sewers, jobs like this. This woman on the screen, extraordinary person. Her name is Amun Slim. I was also, again, very lucky to meet her, and she was very generous in sharing stories and sharing access to her community. She's done amazing work over 20 years or more, building community support networks among the Dom within her own community and relating from between the Dom and the outside world as well. She started in 1999 or so distributing blankets and essentials to families in need. In 2005, she was able to set up a community support hub just outside the walls of the old city in Shuafat. And she now runs vocational training classes for women. She runs language classes. She has after-school clubs who are putting Dom children through school and then some also on into college as well. And of course, inevitably, Amun herself, in and of herself, as well as facing down discrimination from the Israeli authorities and racism from wider Palestinian society, as a woman as well, she is also breaking down gender barriers within her own community as well. She's an extraordinarily dynamic and committed and dedicated person. I was very lucky, as I say, to come and meet her. If you have a chance to be in Jerusalem and you have a chance to go to her community center, it's one of those places where there's always energy, there's something going on. Somebody's learning something there, somebody's making something there, somebody's distributing something there. She is a wonder. Speaking of racism and discrimination, there's also a center of African settlement in Jerusalem, right at the gates of Al-Aqsa. This is a community of about 450 Muslim people who have their origins in West Africa, Central Africa. This is Moussa Kaus, who volunteers at the African Community Center there. As I was drawing these stories together, all of this seemed to serve to me that to reinforce the idea that if your history of Jerusalem doesn't include Black history, Dom history, Indian history, in its very broadest definition, Arab history, then you're not telling the whole story of the city. This lady is Maysoon Al-Maslahi. She's Palestinian, but her family originates from Morocco and Algeria. She is one of the very last remnants of Jerusalem's Moroccan quarter, as was, which was flattened by Israel in 1967 in order to create the big plaza that we now see in front of the Western Wall in the old city, which is a long and horrifying story, which is too long for now, but I was very proud to be able to go into it in my book as well, in detail. A few steps away from her place is the tailoring outlet of this chap, who is Sami Barsoum, who is the mayor of the Syriac Christian community, not Syrian, but they're an ethnic group who originate in what we might think of now as Kurdistan, the borderlands between Syria and Iraq and Turkey. But they're not Kurdish. They belong to a church which uses the Syriac language, one of the dialects of Aramaic, which was a lingua franca across the region before Arabic. And this one image sort of highlights the nonsense of exclusivity as well. Maysoon's house and the mosque that she looks after are in what's now called the Jewish quarter, but she is not Jewish. And Sami lives and works and prays within the boundaries of what's called the Armenian quarter, but he's not Armenian. I'm getting signals here. There are more stories I want to tell. This guy is very interesting. This is a heterodox Jewish community, which I'm going to have to skip over just to move on because we're running out of time. But just before we move to conversation, I just want to end, if I can, just with this one serious and important point. This is the cover of the new book that I've been working on over the last few months. This is a Bradford exclusive. This cover was only finished yesterday, and it's a book called Daybreak in Gaza, which comes out later this year. Over the last 9 months, Israel has dropped the equivalent of 3 Hiroshima-sized nuclear bombs on the people of Gaza. Israel has pushed 2 million of the survivors out of their homes and into destitution. And now Israel is starving children to death in Gaza. Friends and guests and readers and writers, there is a genocide happening again, now. So next week and next month and next year, when somebody asks you, or you ask yourself, what did you do during the genocide? Please make sure that you have an answer, and the answer is not nothing. The Palestinian people are under intense pressure everywhere. And in Jerusalem, Israel is working to try and make life there untenable for anybody who is not Jewish. So, you know, these stories of mystics and tombs and all the different communities of Jerusalem are fun, and I love them, and they humanize the people of the old city, which is my purpose. But also my purpose in writing these stories was to weaponize them. There's a job to do among people like me, people like us, in terms of addressing the continued viability of how far things have been allowed to go in Israel. And a good place to start, I think, is in encouraging us all to reimagine Jerusalem without its four colonially imposed ethno-nationalist quarters. Thank you very, very much indeed. I'll now move this out of the way so we can have a decent conversation. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Matthew.
That
was wonderful to hear more about the book. And I think what I really appreciated reading it is just your voice is a good one to listen to, because you have a lot of energy for the characters that you meet, and you have a lot of interest in their stories and their back history. And then in what you were just saying now, it's just to be reminded of that earlier points in history in Jerusalem and in Palestine and in British intervention in the region and our response. Britain's responsibility with regards to Palestine being drawn out, and also the artificiality of these the way that we look at cities, and we've been taught to look at cities and to be told that certain people cannot live together,
you know,
constantly being reinforced when there has been such long histories of coexistence. So it's really important what you do, and it was very good to hear you speaking now. I'd like to just bring in Abdurrahman, who's here. He's got an earlier point of history which is of interest to him, which is that of Salah ad-Din. And for most people, I think, familiar with the name Salah ad-Din, he's like the great heroic warrior who fought against the Crusaders and liberated Jerusalem. If they could write it on a sort of post-it note, that's probably what they'd say. But you've gone beyond that. So tell us a little bit about what captured, why did he capture your imagination so much to go into an area of study which a lot of books and films have already covered? Were there not more minor characters that you could have looked at first?
The thing about Salah ad-Din, I mean, first of all, thank you, Matthew, for your very moving words on Jerusalem.
Thank you. Completely
support you in your arguments. You can't get beyond Salah ad-Din, because the fantastic thing about Salah ad-Din is that the legend is far, far more interesting than the truth. Well, you know, the myth is always greater. As a young boy, I grew up, and anybody of our age will remember, the Lady Bird books. And there were these wonderful Lady Bird books of Saladin. And there's this wonderful story of him and Richard the Lionheart, these two great heroes. And they were trying to show who was stronger. So Richard would take out his big sword and he'd sort of slash through his steel bar and say, you know, this is the mighty England. And Salah ad-Din would throw up a silk scarf and just hold his sword very still, and the scarf would come down, and so sharp was the sword that it would cut in two. And I remember looking at that when I was 6, 7 years old, and I just fell in love with history and Salah ad-Din. And it was years later, of course, that I realized the two men never met, and that, in fact, history is far, far more. And so we remember the legend. And what you just said, if I ask people, what do you know about Salah ad-Din, they're going to say 2, 3 things. They might know he's Kurdish. He was a Kurd. Well, that, of course, means a lot if you understand the dynamic of the Muslim world at that time. And they actually say, the second thing they say is that he was the one who conquered Jerusalem, of course. And then the third one is, of course, his chivalry, his honor, his nobility, and so forth. But what I found really interesting, and that's why I wrote my book, was to make an argument that sometimes what we're most famous for is assumed to be our greatest achievement. So Salah ad-Din is most famous for conquering Jerusalem. And so the argument goes that was his greatest achievement. My book argues quite the contrary. And without going too much into the book and focusing on Jerusalem, because I think that's why we're here today. And here one has to be very careful. When I say that, you know, there's a huge strand within Israeli Western academia that tries to undermine the importance of Jerusalem. Jerusalem does not matter. Why the Arabs and the Muslims fighting so much for it, it didn't really matter. And there's records of historical sources where it was neglected for centuries, therefore it wasn't important for the Muslims. Jerusalem mattered incredibly. For every Muslim, the fall of Jerusalem in 1098 caused an absolute shock. And just as a side, if one can say that in 1085, 14 years before the fall of Jerusalem, Toledo fell in Al-Andalus in Spain. And often we don't read our history like this, but you've got to read the history parallel, you know, almost sliding door moments. The fall of Toledo in 1085 in Spain and the fall of Jerusalem in 1098 are actually linked. These were the very first time a Muslim city had ever fallen to non-Muslims. So Jerusalem mattered, and I think that's all I need to say at this point, but it actually did not matter. And this is where we come back to Salah ad-Din and why it so matter. Salah ad-Din spent his years trying to recover Jerusalem from 1098. He recovered it in 1187. Jerusalem for 88 years or 89 years was not in the hands of the Muslims. And here is an aside, just for us sitting in this room having think about all this, history sometimes is deceptive. It plays illusions with us. We're all born within the period of post-1948. We're all living in the field where we, you know, Israel's been with us since, you know, all our births, and we grew up. And the narrative that goes through is that, you know, Israel's been with us, Israel's going to be with us. This is the state of affairs, occupied Palestine, so forth. We go back to Salah ad-Din's time. It was an 88-year period between the fall of Jerusalem and its recovery. If we look today, we've had about 75-odd years. There are people who are still alive who actually were living at the time before Israel even existed. Do not be fooled by history. What may appear as certain can change very quickly. So that's one thing I learned as a historian, that don't assume that things, because they appear in a certain way, don't shift. The sands of, you know, history shift very quickly. But just a quick point about Jerusalem, because it is important. And it's so interesting because what Matthew is talking about is a Jerusalem which is post-Napoleon, 1840s, and then, of course, you're going through the, you know, Holocaust, and of course, 48 and so forth, and Nakba. In Salah ad-Din's time, of course, none of this existed. Jerusalem was a city within an Islamic ummah. The caliph was in Baghdad. There was two caliphs. There was the Sunni caliph in Baghdad, and there was the Ismaili Shia caliph in Egypt. And the Muslim world was in complete turmoil, utter turmoil, fighting amongst everything. But there was a huge, huge difference between the Muslim world today and then. Huge difference. And that is the self-confidence that the Muslims had then. And this is a very important point. This was the age, just before Salah ad-Din's time, this was the age of people like Al-Ghazali, of Abdul Qadir al-Jilani. This was a very vibrant, very strong age. And that the Crusaders, when they came to the Holy Lands to capture Jerusalem, and this is again a big, the Crusaders is a Western obsession. In fact, the Crusaders had very little impact on the Muslim lands. They came down and remained on the coast. They made some inroads, of which, of course, Jerusalem was one. Edessa was another one. But by and large, they remained on the coast. Far more dramatic an impact on the Muslim lands were the Mongols, who came just a few years later and devastated the Muslim world. If you lived in Baghdad, you never actually met a Crusader. You never met a French Frank. You never interacted with them. But when Salah ad-Din started to come into power, and his was a movement which is known as the Sunni Revival. It's too complicated and too long to talk about now, but I write about it in my book. It's an intellectual movement that started in Baghdad under people like Nizam al-Mulk al-Ghazali and so forth. And Salah ad-Din and his patron, a man called Nuruddin Zengi, and of course his father Zengi, started this movement. They realized a couple of very important things. And that was to lose Jerusalem, which caused a huge shock, was extremely grave and extremely dangerous. But what they could not afford to do was to lose Cairo or Damascus or Aleppo or the big cities of the Muslim world. Because if these had fallen to the Crusaders or the Franks, then the situation would have been much graver. Symbolically, spiritually, metaphysically, in eschatological terms, Jerusalem was vitally important. In military and strategic terms, Jerusalem was not important. And that is why I have to be quite very careful when I speak like this, because people then think, oh, you know, you're somehow belittling Jerusalem. No. When Salah ad-Din came to power, and as I said, the whole struggle for the first 20 or 30 years of his career, he did not capture Jerusalem until 1187. He died in 1192, 93. So he was dead within 2-3 years of capturing Jerusalem, very late in his life. He spent the early years of his life, as did Nur ad-Din, trying to unify Syria, Damascus, and Aleppo, trying to control Egypt. Because the lesson that he understood, and the important lesson in those days, was that you had to unify the Muslim world. And if you did that, and by Muslim world, I meant Iraq, Syria, and Egypt as the three axes of Sunni power. If you did that, Jerusalem had to fall. And if Salah ad-Din had not captured Jerusalem, Salah ad-Din's greatest achievement was not his capture of Jerusalem. As I said in my book, his greatest achievement is that he became the vizier of Egypt, and he restored Egypt back into the Sunni fold. The moment that Egypt and Syria became one, he was the Sultan of Syria and Egypt, Jerusalem had to fall, because Jerusalem ultimately could not defend itself. And there are many stories which I can go into later on about that, because of course, you know, no, unless we can keep that too. But that's just a very quick history lesson. But it was a completely different age from what Matthew's been writing about.
Can I ask you something? How is Salah ad-Din seen today in popular culture across the Arab world or across the Muslim world? I'm thinking of, I don't know, Ramadan TV specials.
Of course, the Turkish ones that came out recently.
What's or in books or in literature.
Let me tell you two things about Salah ad-Din which are fascinating. The tomb of Salah ad-Din in Damascus, and anybody who goes to Inshallah, if you go back to Damascus, you'll see it. If I asked you who actually built his Muslim's tomb, this may surprise you. It was actually Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany. And the reason was because when Kaiser Wilhelm visited Damascus in 1898, he was so shocked by how dilapidated Salah ad-Din's tomb was that he ordered its building. Now, the question to answer your question is why was it in such a state? The truth is, Salah ad-Din was ignored and forgotten in the Muslim history. As long as Jerusalem was in Muslim hands, Salah ad-Din was forgotten. The Salah ad-Din we're talking about today is the Salah ad-Din of the 18th and 19th century, who was brought back to life by the Muslims as an opposition when Jerusalem fell again. The Salah ad-Din, which Saddam Hussein, of course, and Saddam Hussein made a huge thing out of it because both came from Tikrit in Iraq. The Salah ad-Din that Hafez al-Assad had, the statue of Salah ad-Din, Abd al-Nasser, Yusuf Shaheen's film in Egypt with Ahmed Mazhar and all that. This is Abd al-Nasser, Salah ad-Din. It's nothing to do with the historical Salah ad-Din. Arafat, Gaddafi, all of these people assumed that mantle of Salah ad-Din because Jerusalem was not in Muslim hands. Between 1187 and 1914 or so, Salah ad-Din was by and large forgotten because they didn't need him. So the Salah ad-Din now that's returned to us as this kind of mantle, and you know the Turkish series, the Ramadan series and all that, it's all romanticized, it's all harking back to this, what the Muslim world needs is another Salah ad-Din. And every time I give a talk, people come back and say, do we need another Salah ad-Din? Of course, the answer is no, we don't need a Salah ad-Din. We need to get off our backsides and actually create the age in which Salah ad-Din became, you know, managed to emerge from. But it's that going back to this kind of mythical Salah. So to answer your question, the Salah ad-Din that now people talk about is very much a product of 19th and 20th century political results and not history. Because if Salah ad-Din, why Salah ad-Din? Why not Baybars? Why does Baybars not have this mantle of greatness? Why is Salah ad-Din so famous that you cannot almost criticize him? He's on the same level as the companions of the Prophet. He's almost above criticism. If I stand out in certain and say, oh, he was a terrible man, people would kind of attack, oh, what do you mean, Mr. Salah ad-Din? You can't say that. So he's been adorned with this kind of mantle of almost spiritual greatness. But of course, when he dissected, he was just a Kurdish warlord. He was an incredible man. He was brilliant. He was generous, chivalrous, of course. But we cannot read history through the eyes of today's defeat and Jerusalem being occupied. We have to read history as his time, when he was extremely confident that Jerusalem was in Muslim hands for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Thank you for that. Yeah. I'm aware of time, actually. I had like a list of questions, but it's we're already up to the Q&A time. No, not at all.
It was wonderful.
It ended up as sort of like two presentations, yes. And then opening up to you, and if question at the front.
Thank you, that was really interesting. Why do you think Salah ad-Din was forgotten in the Muslim world? Because he obviously did loads, you know, he achieved a lot. Why do you think for that period just before 1914 that, you know, he was so forgotten that his tomb was dilapidated? Sorry if that's...
No. It's a very good question.
Multifaceted.
Salah ad-Din was an amazing man. He was an incredible man. And I spent 3 years reading about him and the rest of the last 10 years since my book, obsessing about him. He was an incredible man in his chivalry and his honor. Truly exceptional. Salah ad-Din's greatness was because he tried to the best of his abilities, he was not an intellectual, he was more a very simple warlord, to follow the principles and the morals of the Prophet himself. He really wanted to become as good a Muslim and to follow the steps of the Prophet. Once he captured, and of course, you cannot talk about Salah ad-Din without Nur ad-Din, without the others, they were all great as well. But Islamic civilization, society at that time was full of great people. I mentioned the Ghazali, I can mention Abdul Qadir Jilani, I can mention so many others, because as long as Jerusalem was in safe hands, as long as the Muslim Ummah was more or less controlled, the Crusaders from time to time would come and try to knock out a bit of Egypt, of Syria, they'd be pushed back because of the self-confidence they had. There's a diary of a man, a contemporary of Salah ad-Din, called Usama ibn Munkith, who wrote the memoirs of the Syrian gentleman, in which he talks about the Crusaders. Mm-hmm. He's horrified by them. He said, these people never wash. Mm. We can smell them.
Yeah.
Yeah. These people eat pork. And there's this wonderful story where one of these knights who became his friend, and he says to him, you know, they became really good friends. He said, you know what, I'm going to take your son back to Europe so I can educate him. He was horrified. He said, if I send my son to Europe, he'll never come back. We don't want these people. There was a tremendous sense of confidence. The one difference between today and then, we've lost our confidence. Why is not a huge story. We're not going to get into that. Colonialism, post-colonialism. Mm. The most incredible thing about Salah ad-Din and the period after him was this incredible sense of intellectual confidence in who they were. And Salah ad-Din, for all his greatness, was just one of many. So it's not that he was forgotten. There were just so many. It's just he became famous because he captured Jerusalem. Once Jerusalem fell, and once the colonialism came in, the self-confidence was broken, the Muslims look back and they pick up Salah ad-Din as the hero. He was exceptional, but he lived in an age, centuries of exceptional people.
I'm just going to crash in if I can and just ask a question, because we have Selma on stage with us. And Selma, you've written very evocatively about Gaza. I mentioned Gaza before, but also we're talking about Jerusalem as well. I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of having to represent the British Palestinian diaspora, but I'm very interested in how the last short period, the last 9 months since October the 7th, has been for you and for people who are connected to Palestine beyond my sort of outsider status in terms of speaking and writing, and what Gaza means, what's the meaning of Gaza, and also what's the meaning of Jerusalem as well.
Oh, gosh. Thank
Sorry,
you.
That's a big question.
It's a big question. No, thank you for it. I mean, I think I'm very privileged, and I've been, compared to a lot of my friends, I know some people in Gaza. One of my friends, Ghassan Abu Sitter, was one of the doctors who went into Shifa Hospital and then was in Ahli, and we were at school together and in Kuwait, and, you know, he's somebody who's like a brother to me. And so it was extraordinarily difficult, that period, in particular in the beginning, because it went off the scale as to anything we'd anticipated. And I really like the point that you were making in terms of having a historic perspective on things and the way that our imagination works when we look forward, and the role of fiction and storytelling, because sometimes I think we get two things. One, we're not able to imagine horrific things well enough. Because I wrote, you know, I was once asked to write science fiction based in Gaza in 2048. Mm-hmm. All of the other writers in the anthology, which are outside, we didn't have sight of each other's pieces. All of the pieces set in Gaza in 2048, we still had the siege on, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think of the Berlin Wall, that was only 25 years. So why don't we imagine this thing to have gone? We need to be more positive. But then when I met my friend Ahmed Masoud, who's from Jabalia refugee camp, who has lost so many members of his family, and his mother was trapped inside his family members were trapped inside for a long time. He lost it. His brother was killed. I met him outside the London Book Fair during this vigil for Palestine, and we were both saying we never in our wildest imaginations would have imagined this kind of killing. I mean, the figures you put up for the whole of the old city of Jerusalem, 35,000, we've got 38,000 dead people. It's the whole of that old city.
At least.
But, you know, it's like it's quite hard to compute the numbers, and I don't feel that, you know, what I'm going through is anything compared to the people I know, but we're just trying to mobilize ourselves, be as articulate as we can. Some weeks we're better than others. And I think that it's also to be a bit positive about the sort of the voices found and the coalitions being built around Palestine, and in terms of, you know, self-respect as Arabs, and, you know, an opposition to and a calling out of Islamophobia. I think that there's a much greater awareness with the younger generations. I think social media has been quite positive. There's been a lot of closing down of spaces, both physical spaces, like with Palfest, also, you know, digital spaces, as being, you know, digital rights issues on the Palestine-Israel front are massive in terms of how Palestinian journalist content or Palestinian content gets taken down repeatedly. It gets shadow banned. And this is a direct link between Tel Aviv and, you know, the Googles and Facebooks and Metas of this world. There's a direct sort of communication as to whose accounts go down. Also, the just as you know, as you will know, the silencing through the direct targeting of journalists. I mean, it's got to the point. I've been writing blogs for the London Review of Books since November. And it's like in the beginning, we had quite a few journalists inside, but now it's like, really, I'm sort of looking at young girls like Bizan, you know, for my news. You're like looking at a 23-year-old to represent this story. And then some of the Western journalists, a couple of them, not enough of them, are really vocal and are furious that they can't get in.
Yeah.
Alex Crawford from Sky News being a case in point. She has tried three times through Egypt, through Israel, and she's not getting anywhere. And it's people are being, obviously, for different reasons. They're not, these journalists are not getting in. So the story's not getting out. And I find the level of rhetoric coming out of Israel in terms of what they're being sort of allowed to say while this country and other similar countries are still dealing with them, are still providing them with arms. That hurts me as a Brit, hurts my mother as a, you know, I mean, it's just to be allied with people like the current Israeli government is infuriating and in a sense makes one incensed. What can you say? I mean, to be described as being, you know, dehumanized in this way, as being sort of rats and targets, and to have like senior officials saying that.
I think the best thing that's come out of Gaza, if one can say that, is this kind of dropping of this, you know, Western media hypocrisy, and that with the realization that, you know, we need to find alliances which cut across, and labeling Israel an apartheid state, no matter how angry it makes them, is speaking truth. And this truth now resonates and transcends an Islamic discourse and can actually appeal to anybody with a sense of justice. And so if one can look at the positive thing that's come out, is that now really the veil has dropped. The pretense that somehow Israel is the only democracy in the region and all that. And also, as you said, the fact that the UK government and the Western governments continue to support it, despite overwhelming evidence that war crimes have been committed and the mental gymnastics that the governments have to go through here just to sort of, oh no, you know, misfiring missiles, whatever it is. If I can just make two quick points about Salah al-Din and Gaza, because it isn't, you know, just, first of all, it was Salah al-Din who actually protected the Jews. We've got to remember that. It was Salah al-Din who allowed the Jews back into Jerusalem. In the First Crusade, the Jews were massacred by the Christians. Secondly, Gaza was extremely dear to him. His greatest vizier, his closest confidant, was a man called Al-Qadi al-Fadl, who came from Gaza. For Salah al-Din, Gaza was extremely important. Ascalon and the whole area of Gaza was of extreme vital importance, and it's one that he dearly, dearly loved. And it was very much a vibrant, homogeneous community, extremely rich, because it was the trade links between Syria and Egypt. And protecting Gaza for Salah al-Din was absolutely critical, and I write about this because it gave him the link between Syria and Egypt. So the Gaza that I write about is unrecognizable. Rich history, legacy, mosques and knowledge and scholars and trade and wealth.
And this targeting of the cultural heritage.
Absolutely.
You know, like one of the third oldest churches in the world, like archaeological sites, the decimation of the mosques of, I mean, it's, and the fact that there has been so little outrage over. Anyway,
but this goes back to what you were saying. We cannot, and I mentioned this, just because things look permanent, they're not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
History has taught me this again and again and again. 88 years, that's all it was at that time. And yet today we talk about Israel. So what we're seeing, horrific as it is, you have no idea how things quickly can turn.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to remain optimistic.
I think we have, we've got 2 minutes left for a question.
Yeah. That's a question here.
Well, it's a little bit more of a statement, actually, but Selma and myself have honourable differences of opinion, and we've argued
shared them in the bookshop,
Yeah, the long and short is you've been very heavy on the pro-Palestine front, and I'm not Jewish, but my father was an ordinary Joe from Bingley. He was a tank commander at D-Day, and they liberated Belsen. And after liberating Belsen, he said, I want to tell you once and once only, and he described it, don't tell your mum, because it'll frighten her. But the Jews, if anyone ever asks you if the Jews deserve a homeland. Tell them there are six.
Would you be able to address your question to Matthew, just because he's yeah. Jewish? I think that it might yeah. be the best
but
to...
Before Matthew yes. says anything, I am unashamedly pro-Palestinian.
That's fine.
And if I take one side, it's because I've seen the horrors in my own eyes.
I understand that. So. I understand that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would also
I'm trying to be even-handed. Right?
Oh, no, we've gone beyond even-handedness now.
I agree with you. Please.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, he said, you know, I disagree with you. But he said, you know, do the Jews deserve a homeland? If anyone asks you, tell them there are 6 million reasons why. And there are 6 million reasons. Well, exactly. Well, come on, Cornwall. Yeah. You know, they would argue they have a legitimate right and historical there. But do you not agree that a two-state solution is the only practical solution now?
I disagree with you on both fronts.
Right,
we have like no seconds left to speak, but I'll do what I can. The conflation of Jews with the State of Israel, unfortunately, I would classify as anti-Semitic. I think it's a mistake to conflate the idea that because of what happened in the Holocaust, should then happen in Palestine, what's happened in 1948 and since, is an error. It's a mistake to conflate the two. You can see it as an innocent mistake, or you can see it as a racist, anti-Semitic mistake. As far as a two-state solution goes, no, I don't agree. That's the only way forward. Two-state solution, especially as it's promulgated at the moment, will only embed inequality, the inequalities that exist already. The land borders that have been drawn are arbitrary. They're ceasefire lines from 1949. They have no relevance on the ground. And the idea that a solution that, for instance, denies Palestinian right of return to Jaffa or Haifa could ever be just, I think, is for the birds. The way forward, the solution, if there is one, inevitably is going to rely on equality of status and equality mm-hmm. of opportunity
exactly.
in a democratic state.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to wrap up now. Thank you for being a great audience. And please do go out and buy these fantastic books. I didn't get an opportunity to speak about your other work, which we've been chatting about before, but the last...
It sounds extraordinary, this extraordinary tale mm-hmm. of a you can tell it better than I can, but a Robinson Crusoe-like character.
Very, very quickly. It's called The Other Exile. It's about a real-life story of a man who lived on the island of St. Helena 300 years before Napoleon in complete isolation for 30 years, a Portuguese nobleman. And I tell his story. It's a wonderful story. Mm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.